Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and we're doing something special for this Pledge Week edition of Eastern Standard, the works of the WEKU staff, all in one place at one time. Stu Johnson gets us started with the latest in chemical weapons destruction at the Bluegrass Army Depot near Richmond, and how local officials are feeling about the future economic impact on the region once the last weapon is gone.
More street traffic than foot traffic on a recent weekday morning in downtown Richmond. Just a few miles away, the 500-plus tons of stored chemical weapons at the Army Depot are slowly but surely falling in number. Rick Allen, a Richmond native, works downtown at an insurance company. Mustard and nerve agent destruction is not something that keeps Allen awake at night.
I know some people that work out there and some people that were involved in the engineering process over, and talking to them, it was basically over-engineered multiple times. So it wasn't just one case of redundancy, it was redundancy on top of redundancy. So not as much concerned about that. Seems like they've got a pretty good, you know, hold on as far as that goes.
And Allen says, although it might be a different disposal technique, the track record at other Army installations around the country also breeds confidence in safety measures here. Work to destroy the munitions through a neutralization process and, in some cases, in a static detonation chamber happens at the Bluegrass Chemical Agent Destruction Pilot Plant. Site project manager Candace Coyle reported last week about 28% of the chemical stockpile has been destroyed. Most recently, the second of five separate disposal campaigns for VX nerve agent projectiles was completed. Next up is the startup of VX nerve agent rockets, scheduled to get going next month.
You know, the rockets is what we have left. It is the most complex and the highest risk, but we also know we're making the community safer as we go along. So I think this is just a phenomenal team, a phenomenal accomplishment, but we have a lot more work to do.
No matter the type of chemical munitions, Coyle says the same respect for safety is used. What to do with the wastewater product generated by the agent neutralization process has been a topic for discussion. Advisory panels have been briefed on plans to move some 243 truckloads of hydrolysate to an incinerator operation in Port Arthur, Texas. Darcy Maupin is with St. Joseph Health in Berea and has served on the Chemical Destruction Community Advisory Board for 9 years. When complications developed for dealing with the wastewater product on site, attention then turned to trucking it off to another location. Maupin believes it's a viable alternative.
I feel fairly confident in the process of having it shipped off. I mean, we certainly would have loved for it to have been managed the way that it was originally scheduled to, but the risk, you know, in the plant to use the SQUO, I think, was a little bit more dangerous with some of the processes that weren't working correctly.
SQUO is the acronym for Supercritical Water Oxidation System, a secondary waste processing of chemical agent. Maupin, meanwhile, says the Army has been in step with the community, and that has helped to generate confidence. As it relates to the hydrolysate makeup, project manager Candace Coyle says it will not contain any nerve agent residue. She compares it to a commercial cleaning product. Weapon destruction began just over 2 years ago, with the end goal for completion the end of 2023. If all goes well, Coyle says a year from now could find the overall effort reaching midpoint.
Assuming we have no leakers from this next campaign, which we don't anticipate, VX rockets in the past have been very low estimated for having that experience, we will be probably about 49% complete. Mm-hmm. The GB rockets are about 51% of our inventory. So hopefully at this time next year, we'll be at 49% and then just getting ready to start the last campaign.
But that won't be the final chapter. Then all energies will go toward shutting down disposal operations and possible reuse of some non-agent impacted facilities. Discussion about preserving some 1,400 jobs has been going on for quite a while. Madison County Judge Executive Reagan Taylor says keeping those jobs is a key focus. The county government head says losing them and the associated revenues would be devastating. And federal dollars for an emergency radio system plus associated vehicles and equipment will dry up. Taylor says the county will need to think about adding more jobs.
We can't look at this that we've got to keep 1,400 jobs. We got to look at this that, hey, we need 2,000 more jobs. Because we have all these infrastructure components that are going to cost us money now, buying fire trucks, buying vehicles in the road department, all those things that the CSEP program has put in to our local economy and to our local governments now is going to become a cost to us.
CSEP stands for Chemical Stockpile Emergency Preparedness Program. Kentucky Chemical Destruction Advisory Board co-chair Craig Williams of Berea has been involved in one way or another with depot demilitarization for more than three decades. Now, one of his interests as a community advocate is site reuse. Williams wonders about using the two static detonation chambers for conventional weapons once chemical agent destruction is done.
Right now, they open burn and open detonation, obsolete conventional weapons. These two static detonation chambers that are out there are perfect fit for taking care of that material in a much more environmentally sound and public health protective manner.
Williams says the decision has not yet been made at any level, Army, state, or community, as to what will happen with the infrastructure on the depot grounds. Richmond insurance agent George Ridings represents the business sector on the advisory board. He says any pilot plant facilities with any direct connection to nerve agent disposal will be razed, torn down. Ridings says the hope is the Army can offer employment with a new use for remaining buildings. And Ridings says a major loss of workers could also mean emptying a few hundred houses, creating a glut of housing. All these issues will get further attention, but Writing says everyone agrees eliminating the 500-ton stockpile of weapons is the end game.
It's going to be great to get this over, and it will no longer be a topic. Even though there are some downsides of this project ending, certainly the great goal for everybody has been to remove it quickly as possible, as safely as possible, with no damage to people or the environment.
It remains a step-at-a-time process. The next step is a startup of Phase 3 of chemical munition disposal, the destruction of nerve agent rockets slated to start in July. The Bluegrass Depot, along with a similar Army operation in Pueblo, Colorado, are the only two remaining storage sites. The Colorado facility is scheduled for closure once it completes its chemical munition disposal mission. I'm Stu Johnson for WEKU's Eastern Standard.
See, we're always happy. Last we live in here, that's our philosophy.
For more than a year, because of the pandemic, many Kentucky students haven't had a chance to get outside and go on a field trip. But that's changing this summer. WEKU's Samantha Morrill has this report.
The Summer Field Trip Initiative was created through a partnership with Lieutenant Governor Jacqueline Coleman, the Education and Workforce Development Cabinet, the Kentucky Department of Education, and New Pioneers for a Sustainable Future. Whitney Wurzel is New Pioneers Executive Director.
We are a nonprofit organization that is based in Springfield, Kentucky, and our mission is to advance sustainability in rural communities through education, demonstration, and advocacy.
With that mission in mind, New Pioneers created nature-themed field trips for Kentucky students, many of whom have been largely stuck inside for the last year.
To get students outside is so very important, and we look forward to welcoming them to get them comfortable with the outdoors and curious about nature, because we find that when students have those two things, both comfort and curiosity paired together, that's when the learning naturally starts to take place. So we just feel fortunate to be able to give students the ability to do that.
Wurzel says when her organization was approached about creating the field trips, they immediately knew where they would take place. The Sisters of Charity of Nazareth campus in Nelson County and the Loretto Mother House campus in Marion County.
Both of these organizations have been New Pioneers partners from the very beginning of our founding in 2005. And we have partnered with them on a number of initiatives over the years. And even in the last year, we came to conversations about, They have these amazing properties that are beautiful and filled with ecological integrity. How do we go about showcasing and sharing those properties with more of the public? So when the summer field trip possibility came up, the connections pretty much made themselves and just became an optimal outdoor learning space for students.
The field trips are being offered to students from kindergarten to high school seniors. Wurzel says New Pioneers education team has created activities for students of all ages, tailored based on the grade level and the learning needs of the students.
So thinking about that from a broad perspective, that could be everything from doing insect safaris and, of course, learning the basics of what makes a bug a bug. We're going to be in the creek. We're going to be looking for water bugs, bugs that live in the water, which might sound kind of creepy and crawly, but we learned that those bugs actually help us measure the water quality of the creek. So we're going to be splashing around, identifying organisms and monitoring creek quality. We'll also be spending time in I know the Sisters of Charity, that they have a community garden where we're even going to get to do some taste testing this summer, fresh produce right out of the ground. And then just a lot of observing and considering plant life, animal life in Central Kentucky, what our different habitats and ecosystems are, and the many connections between all of those elements. So it's really to explore, discover, and unlock sort of the secrets and the stories and the magic behind the natural world.
The field trips are available to students from any public, private, or homeschool setting. Wurzel says so far they've had a lot of interest from the homeschoolers.
Which has been a pleasant surprise, I think, because so many of those groups have connections that they're in communication during the summer. And I should emphasize that any groups are welcome to come out. They can be school groups, they can be camp groups, scout groups, church groups. We just want students. We don't mind which group they're a part of.
And for that matter, Wurzel says students don't have to be part of a formal group. They just have to be a group. So a family with lots of school-age siblings, cousins, their friends, that's a group. Or maybe a neighborhood with lots of school-age kids.
As long as there was one parent that was willing to act as the ringleader and get in contact with me, we would be more than happy to work out that experience. And I should also mention that we have just started to look into some possibilities of possibly doing some pop-up environmental education programs, perhaps at farmers markets or libraries or in conjunction with other activities where there are already families in place. Mm. So if any of your listeners are out there and have an idea where we might be able to go and be part of something you're already offering, you know, reach out and let us know that we are all about maximizing partnerships and working with the community and offering things that work with folks' schedules and their needs.
The big takeaway at the end of the day, Wurzel says,
I hope that we nurture a sense of respect and wonder for nature and the environment. I hope that students feel comfortable being outdoors. I hope that they feel curious by the things that they see and that they are excited enough to ask questions and dig in. So at the end of the day, that they feel a kinship with nature. They appreciate nature, and they understand some of the cycles and the power in nature, because it's once we get that love for nature established that students can then feel motivated to protect and preserve our natural spaces, which are just astounding in Central Kentucky, and we should all feel very, very proud of what we got and get behind preserving and celebrating it.
The field trips are available on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. Trips to the Sisters of Charity of Nazareth campus in Nelson County are open until July 23rd. The Sisters of Loretto Motherhouse property in Marion County trips are available from July 27th through August 6th. The only cost to participating groups is transportation and meals. You can learn more at newpioneersfsf.org. I'm Samantha Morrill for WEKU's Eastern Standard.
Coming up after the break, Sherry Lawson on how Kentucky folk artist Minnie Atkins spent the pandemic.
It would look better if I hadn't cut its beaks short.
And later in the hour, Corinne Boyer on what's behind COVID vaccination hesitation in Kentucky's Native American communities, and Wendy Barnett on pandemic issues among our best friends, our pets. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. We're back with more of this special edition of Eastern Standard, highlighting the work of the WEKU staff. WEKU arts reporter Sherry Lawson spent some time with an icon of Eastern Kentucky folk art to see how she spent the pandemic months. Her report made its way all the way up the chain to NPR.
Minnie Atkins has spent almost the entire past year here alone in her home nestled in a valley among the rolling hills of Eastern Kentucky. She sits on her front porch with a long pocket knife and picks up a piece of maple wood.
So are you ready for me to start whittling? All right, here we go. This is better to be whittling outside than it would be in the house, ain't it?
Atkins is known for carving whimsical animals like possums, tigers, and bears. Since the pandemic, she's mostly confined herself at the house, but she stayed busy painting and whittling more than usual.
I whittled 182 pieces from March till September. Then after that, I done 62 paintings.
As she chips away on the piece of wood that's beginning to look like a rooster, she says this time of COVID hasn't changed her style. Judging from the carving in her hand, it's second nature to her.
Well, you see, we just took off all the wood we didn't need and left what we did need. It would look better if I hadn't cut its beak so short.
As a 10-year-old, Atkins taught herself this art form that was primarily dominated by men. The spry wood carver says she would make toys like bows and arrows, pop guns, and whistles. In the mid-1980s, Atkins sold a few of her pieces to a small Kentucky gallery for $32. Now some people pay hundreds of dollars for her carvings. She believes anybody willing to work hard can create folk art.
You don't have to be trained. You don't have to have nobody to teach you. You just do what your being wants to do and what your heart tells you to do.
The Appalachian artist is humble about the recognition she's received, including an award of distinction from the Folk Art Society of America. She's honored her work is featured in permanent collections around the country, like the Smithsonian. Sitting on her front porch, Atkins says the last year and a half doesn't feel real except for all the work she's done. She says she's probably whittled twice as much as usual during this pandemic. She calls her whittling a blessing.
I don't know what I would have done without my carving for the last year because it has helped me so much to get through the lonely days. Only thing, I was making money, but I couldn't get out to spend it, so I guess that was good.
Minnie Atkins says she's ventured out to one baptism since she's been fully vaccinated. She's anxious to see family and get back to church services. For NPR News, I'm Sherry Lawson in Elliott County, Kentucky.
Sherry's reporting went beyond the NPR story. Besides whittling whimsical roosters, tigers, possums, and such for an online art gallery, Minnie Atkins also has spent pandemic time creating characters that are photographed as illustrations for a children's book. Sherry visited with the book's author.
When you listen to Mommy Goose, you may forget the words she said, but 40 years later, they're still in your head.
That's Mike Norris. The Lexington resident has written four children's books, including Bright Blue Rooster and Sonny the Monkey. He's also created a series called Mommy Goose Books with titles like Rhymes from the Mountains and Ring Around the Moon.
How the rooster caught the croup, the June bug yearning for his youth. Lester finally told the
Norris is completing work on the last in the series of Mommy Goose books. He writes the stories, a song, and rhymes for the books, and Kentucky folk artist Minnie Atkins carves characters that are photographed as the illustrations. Norris says Atkins has carved 200 pieces for this third Mommy Goose book.
And she just never ceases to amaze me with her creativity, her work ethic, and her imagination. She doesn't understand a concept that many of us have mastered, and that's procrastination.
In a special room at his home, Norris points to a table where he's arranged all the characters that are in place to be photographed.
You can see there's Mommy Goose heading up some of her flock, and Mommy's big theme is words and the might of words. And as you can see, she's holding a piece of birch bark in her mouth, and she says, Always remember, words are friends that help us weave the outs and ins.
Mommy Goose, when she gets a hole, she don't turn loose. You could run away, but what's the use? Listen to Mommy Goose.
The 72-year-old sends the text to Minnie Atkins so she can begin whittling the characters.
In the Mommy Goose books, she'll take 10 rhymes at a time and we'll talk about what it could be. And then she'll carve stuff and send me pictures. And for the most part, it's, you know, she nails it right off the bat.
The pair have been collaborating for 30 years. They met at an award ceremony at Center College, where Norris worked at the time. Atkins was there to receive an award. Norris gave Atkins and her husband a tour of the campus. He also gave her a cassette tape with a song he'd written called Bright Blue Rooster. Atkins says she whittled a blue rooster and sent it to Norris as a thank you gift. But the song listed other characters as well, like a three-legged hog, a wore-out tractor, and a no-count dog.
Manny called me one day and he said, you know, if you'd make the characters, he said, we'll put it into a children's book.
This is the book of COVID. In March of last year, we had not finished Ring Around the Moon long, and she called me and she said, well, I'm stuck here, I'm isolated. She said, you might as well start sending me some rhymes and let's do another book.
The characters is fun. Mommy Goose is fun herself, and I carved her out and made her into what she is. But them rhymes, there's one called One-Eyed Jack. Now, I like that one. It was about this girl, Betty Lou, a bully, and Jack, because he just had one eye. And then on the end of it, she just presented one Valentine and she'd give it to Jack and asked him to be her. It's got meaning, you know what I mean?
When One-Eyed Jack came to school, his classmates called him One-Eyed Fool. But when the teacher gave a test, his mark was better than the rest. He thought that
Mike Norris says the working title for this final Mommy Goose book is Appalachian Melodies. He expects it to be published sometime next year. In Lexington, I'm Sherry Lawson.
Partnerships are an important part of our efforts. One of those arrangements with the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Vera Institute of Justice brings us a series on criminal justice in eastern Kentucky. Here's Ray Geringer.
In 1966, the U.S. Department of Labor established the Federal Bonding Program to provide fidelity bonds for at-risk or hard-to-place job seekers. The bonds cover the first 6 months of employment at no cost to the job applicant or the employer. Bill Sandell tells us more.
My name is Bill Sandell, and I'm a regional workforce development consultant with Kentucky's Office of Employer and Apprenticeship Services. So we are part of the Education and Workforce Development Cabinet, and our job is really to be navigators for employers in the state to help them kind of understand the various programs and resources that are available to them. And the program was started actually way back in 1966. And it is a federal program that is managed by each of the states. And our office is the state resource office for the bond program. And so what it is a company can receive a $5,000 insurance bond to cover them from employee fraud and dishonesty if they hire at-risk or hard-to-place job seekers. So these are an encouragement for an employer to give folks that have made some mistakes in their past to give them a second chance and get them back into the workforce. It is at no cost to the employer. There's no premiums, there's no deductibles, and it's a 6 month policy. You know, there is a huge pool of candidates out there, a huge pool of people that have experience that would potentially be great employees, but because of some mistakes they've probably made in the past, they are overlooked. You know, and because it was their fault or not, you know, we can talk about that till the cows come home. But the point is that there is this pool of candidates, and especially right now when employers are desperate to hire people. But at the same time, a lot of employers are not willing to take that risk. You know, they look at somebody's background and they say, you know, I really need somebody, but I don't know. You know, they did this thing or that thing, and I just don't know. I don't know if I want that in my here at my place of business. But with the bond, you know, it can take that risk and lessen that risk. So if something does happen, then they can be covered. And the great thing about this program is less than 1% of the bonds since 1966. So, you know, we're talking decades and decades. Less than 1% of the bonds have ever been filed upon. And the reason for that is that a good job is one of the significant factors in reducing recidivism rate. So, you know, you got folks that are coming off recovery or have just gotten out of jail. Having them re-enter the workforce and get their life back on track is one of the number one ways to get them from falling back into old habits and falling back into making mistakes again. And this is one of our ways to help prevent that.
Employers can find out more about the program at www.bonds4jobs.com and can sign up by sending an email to workforce@ky.gov. For WEKU, I'm Ray Geringer.
State of Justice is provided to Eastern Standard by Ray Geringer and Amelia Kirby with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and a grant from the Vera Institute of Justice. Coming up after the break, Corinne Boyer on overcoming history among Native Americans in Kentucky to encourage COVID vaccination.
Our people, we remember, you know, we have elders alive today that were forcibly sterilized.
And from Wendy Barnett, a pandemic, a cat, the return to work, and separation anxiety.
When she would leave, the cat was like a child. It would just lay at the door and be like, meh. Like just crying for a mom.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. We're back with this special edition of Eastern Standard. We're highlighting the work of the WEKU staff. As Kentucky reopens, Corinne Boyer reports on efforts to encourage COVID vaccinations in Kentucky's Native American communities.
Rachel Thunder felt unsure about getting the COVID-19 vaccine.
I had extreme hesitancy in being vaccinated.
But Thunder got her second shot in April.
I am Plains Cree, Nihio. Originally, my people are from Canada, Northern Alberta. I live here in Kentucky.
Thunder is the director of the American Indian Movement, the True People of Indiana and Kentucky chapter. She's been working with the University of Kentucky's College of Pharmacy to get vaccination information out to Native people in Kentucky. But that's a complex endeavor in the Commonwealth, where there's no recognition of state or federal tribal nations. Thunder says Native people are spread out across the state.
They're not grouped together in centralized locations. These people, the people that are here now, have come from other areas, or they're very remnant of the people that were here.
The virus has devastated Native Americans and tribal nations throughout the country. American Indian or Alaska Native persons are 3.3 times more likely to be hospitalized and 2.4 times more likely to die from the virus than whites, according to recent data by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The hospitalization and death rates of Indigenous people are also higher than the rates of Blacks, Asians, and Hispanic persons when compared to whites. Regional efforts have focused on vaccine hesitancy. Thunder says it's important to understand the historical context of the treatment of Native Americans.
The Native people have experienced extreme, you know, lack of trust, you know, devastation, disease, forced sterilization, and our people, we remember, you know, we have elders alive today that were forcibly sterilized.
Grassroots efforts led by Native American women aim to get vaccine information to Indigenous people in Kentucky. Reaching these populations is crucial, as elders who pass down knowledge and traditions have died. But with no centralized health programs like the Indian Health Service, which serves federally recognized nations, some efforts rely on other sources of funding, which has yet to come through. Helen Dancer is recognized by the state of Alabama in the Shawnee tribe. Dancer is the chair of the Kentucky Native American Heritage Commission. She's frequented Eastern Kentucky and says many people don't want to talk about being Indigenous.
We have enclaves of American Indian communities in this Commonwealth. They won't talk to me even because I represent government in this position. I've spent 18 years in Jackson County. They will not identify themselves to me until I have been there a while and I talk about myself.
But Dancer wants people to know that the vaccine is safe. In a video produced by the Kentucky Governor's Office and the Kentucky Department for Public Health, Dancer discusses efforts by the Native American Heritage Commission and the University of Kentucky's College of Pharmacy to create brochures about the vaccine. The video also features Donna Woods, who is 76.
And I advise any of our people, your people, get vaccinated, because that set me free, because I felt so discouraged and afraid. And now, you know, I'm in good shape.
Don Knickerbocker is the board president of the Greater Cincinnati Native American Coalition, which preserves Native American culture through education and advocacy. The coalition also has members in Kentucky.
I belong to the Anishinaabe people from White Earth Nation, and a citizen there. And I'm an enrolled member of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe from the Otter Tail Pillager Band of Indians.
Vaccine hesitancy is not based on mainstream rampant conspiracy theories.
QAnon conspiracies about magnets or tracking devices, that's not what Native people are afraid of at all. I've not heard any of it. As a matter of fact, Native people are like, no, that's baloney. But what they are saying is, I'm not going to get this because this is not a vaccine.
But rather a dangerous and unproven type of medicine, Knickerbocker says. The coalition has reached out to the local health departments to ask for resources to put together a communications campaign for Native people. Health departments have said it's a good idea, but the coalition has not received funding.
It's really disappointing that there's a lot of money and resources flowing, and yet Native leaders are not getting access to this type of funding that we need in order to actually launch this kind of campaign and really mobilize our networks to dispel these rumors. It's causing a health crisis in our communities.
Rachel Thunder says the American Indian Movement helped with a vaccine effort in northern Indiana.
We were able to get Purdue University linked up with the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi to get a mobile vaccine unit out to some of those people that couldn't travel the distance where the vaccine was being provided.
Thunder has worked with the University of Kentucky's College of Pharmacy to reach Native people in rural areas of Kentucky. The College of Pharmacy says it plans to get shots out to these areas by working with community pharmacies and ag extension offices, but the college is waiting on grant funding. Throughout the pandemic, Native American communities have suffered from the loss of elders. Thunder says elders are knowledge keepers and pass down information about traditions, ceremonies, and protocols to younger people.
And when you have something like COVID-19 that is really, really hitting our elderly populations, you see not just a loss of life, which is detrimental, but you also see a loss of information that has been passed between generations.
Knickerbocker receives a newsletter from White Earth Nation. It typically shares monthly updates from the tribal council, including stories and recipes. Obituaries, which are usually about a page, are also published.
And then suddenly it started to be like 5 pages, 8 pages. And that's devastating because I know for myself and for other tribal people, you know, we look at those and we look for our relatives and we look for our people that we know. And it's so difficult.
Thunder says vaccines can save elders and preserve Native American culture. Helen Dancer says she works to get this information out because Indigenous people have suffered too much from the virus.
And that's the reason why I do this. I don't want to lose our people. I don't want to lose our heritage. I don't want to assimilate.
I'm Corinne Boyer for WEKU's Eastern Standard.
How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much?
Our dogs and cats have been right there with us at home as we quarantined during the coronavirus outbreak. Now, all of a sudden, many people are going back to the office. With a look at how that's working out, here's Morning Edition host Wendy Barnett.
As a person who doesn't have any pets, and you heard that right, I don't have any pets, I've been curious how pets have reacted to all the changes that happened during the pandemic. Have they experienced the same emotions we do? The stress, the anxiety, the loneliness? I have questions. I need answers. One of my friends had just adopted a dog, so I called her and asked her. My friend, Erica, told me I needed to talk to her son's girlfriend, Maria, that she had taken in a cat during the pandemic, and the cat was exhibiting severe separation anxiety. But Erica felt it was even worse than that.
Separation trauma. Anxiety is a light term there.
So the cat, who's named Tanis after a character on Maria's favorite TV show, Letterkenny, had become really clingy and kind of depressed, just like a person. Here's Maria.
I have to keep all the doors open so that she can come and find me. And in fact, if we're in the kitchen together and I suddenly leave and she doesn't realize it, she'll cry. And I have to kind of say, you know, I'm in here, Marco.
I mean, it's a cat, right? They're known for their aloofness, their ability to be disaffected by anything. Erica had even witnessed it when Maria would go to her part-time job.
When she would leave, the cat was like a child. It would just lay at the door and be like, meh, meh, like just crying for a mom.
So how does this happen? How did Tanis, a cat, go from, well, acting like a cat to acting like a child needing her mother?
For a time, we had another little boy cat, and he was actually hit by a car right around the time that they started bonding. And after that is when she got really, really clingy.
And it was around this time that Maria began to discover the true personality of Tanis.
She wants to play by herself. She wants to be the queen, but she cannot be left alone without just getting the most angst.
When Maria would go to work, she'd leave Tanis in her bedroom with the door shut. Tanis would lay at the door, peeking her little face under. Erica didn't want to go into Maria's bedroom while she wasn't there, but wanted to do something for Tanis.
I was like, maybe there is a YouTube channel that's for cats with anxiety.
Erica found a YouTube channel that played anxiety music for cats, but when she slid her phone under the bedroom door so that Tanis could listen and possibly relax.
And that little cat threw its arm out from under the door and flipped it off and turned it off and kicked it away. It's like, screw this device. I want a human. And I'm like, I get that.
I wanted to find out more about separation anxiety in pets, specifically during the pandemic. Why are pets having anxiety? Is the pandemic making it worse? And what are pet parents going to do when they do return to work, when children return to school? In my mind, I'm imagining a wasteland of empty homes with animals walking around thinking they've been abandoned for the 8 to 9 hour work and school day. But really, what's going to happen to all of these animals? What can people do to prevent this? Well, there's a podcast for that.
Hello, everybody out there. Welcome to Sit, Stay, Listen with the Kentucky Humane Society. I'm Kate Sale, your host, certified professional dog trainer, coming to you from WFMP Forward Radio in Louisville, Kentucky on 106.5. Check us out on our website, forwardradio.org. Today, we're talking about separation anxiety in dogs.
This was the second episode of the weekly podcast, Sit, Stay, Listen. The first episode, released on January 31st, 2021, discussed trends at animal shelters during COVID. Since I wanted to know more about both of these topics, I contacted the Kentucky Humane Society. My first question was about Tanis, was what she was going through, and what can Maria do? PR and Marketing Director, Andrea Blair.
Unfortunately, separation anxiety, it's a very difficult, once your animal has that, it's a very difficult disorder to treat. It's especially difficult to treat if an animal is surrendered to a shelter. So we definitely want to make sure that people help their animals build that resiliency so that they're comfortable when you leave.
So it seems that prevention is the key here. Kate talks about triggers for separation anxiety, especially for dogs, in her podcast.
One of the main factors that we look at when we talk about our dogs being afraid to be left alone are big life changes, and we all know that this has been a huge factor in our life this year.
And apparently separation anxiety in dogs is nothing new, because on Kate's show, her guest is a certified separation anxiety trainer, Tracy Hagen from Georgetown.
We're seeing a lot more influx of cases, you know, with people going back to work, and now, you know, dogs are having problems with that. And so it's definitely something that is needed, and let people know that there is help for that. The most important thing is to not leave your dog alone more than your dog can handle.
And all of this can be summarized by Anita Spreitzer, president of Paws for the Cause in Lexington.
That puppy that you brought home in the pandemic is not going to understand, why is my mom or my dad not here for 8 hours?
And that's the bottom line. Anita had been working at home in her office during the pandemic, and she has several dogs of her own. She'd been training her dogs for her return to work.
They stay out in the living room during the day. So I keep them out there, and I'm sticking to the 3 times a day walk that they go out into the yard to do their business and come in, because I want to prepare them that I might not be here.
The stress and anxiety that we have all experienced during this time has not just been limited to us humans. So if you're at home right now with your pet, give them a hug. And if you're at work, be sure to give them extra hugs and attention when you get home. They may be sitting there all alone right now, missing you. I'm Wendy Barnett for WEKU's Eastern Standard.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Wendy Barnett our producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest a topic or an interview? You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.